Hi, I want to welcome you all back to the podcast. I took a much-needed break over the last couple of months, and hopefully now I'll get back on track and release some more podcasts. If all goes right, we're going to try to get one out every week. But today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Robert Whittaker, who is the author of 4 books and co-author of a 5th, 3 of which tell the history of psychiatry. In 2010, his Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullet, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness won the U.S. Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for Best Investigative Journalism. Prior to writing books, he worked as a science reporter for the Albany Times Union newspaper in New York for a number of years. He is the founder of MaddenAmerica.com, a website that features research news and blogs by an international group of writers interested in rethinking psychiatry. This is going to be a great interview, and please stay tuned after the show for our post-show talk. Thank you. Hi, Bob, and welcome to the podcast. And I am so glad that you agreed to do this because you are a wealth of information, and I think people are going to really enjoy some of the things that you have to say.
Well, thanks for having me, Geraldine. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be here.
Well, thank you. And today we will do something a little differently. Garrett, since you know both of us, we'll both be asking you questions because he had some really good comments yesterday when we were talking. So I'm going to let him start off with the first question.
Hey, Bob.
Hi, Garrett.
So I think one of the best things that you were able to provide when you had testified for us in front of the Massachusetts legislature for the benzo bill was that you were kind of able to give a historical background to how we got to where we are today, where, you know, people can walk into a doctor's office with a litany of issues and walk out with a benzodiazepine, and that's become normal practice. And, you know, how is it that we get to that point in America?
Well, it's actually quite strange because it's been known for decades that benzodiazepines are addictive and that once you are on them for a couple of weeks, it can be very difficult to come off. And then often then as you come off, you're in worse shape than when you began. The history is this. The first generation of benzodiazepines, and we're talking about Librium and Valium, they come to market in the early 1960s. And within a few years, researchers are saying, hey, wait a minute, I think these drugs are addictive. And by the a decade later, this was seen as a national problem with drugs. I mean, there are articles in women's magazines, other magazines. Ted Kennedy put together a commission to study it. And out of that came an understanding, official government understanding, that these drugs were addictive and they could have withdrawal symptoms and they needed to be used for as short a term time as possible. And because of that, in fact, you saw that benzodiazepine prescriptions went down, and there was actually a beginning of a switch to antidepressants for treating anxiety and milder difficulties. But then in 1980, a second generation benzodiazepine is approved by the FDA, and this is alprazolam, which is going to be marketed as Xanax. And what happens is as it gets marketed, it's marketed as a new benzodiazepine that doesn't cause addiction. And that became the message, the marketing message to make to sell Xanax. And by the early 1990s, it was one of the best-selling drugs on the market. Now, what is so awful about this in terms of a betrayal of the American public is there were studies done of alprazolam on panic disorder in the early 1980s. And what you saw in that study was that although for the first couple of weeks, those randomized to alprazolam compared to placebo did have a greater reduction in their panic symptoms, the number of panic attacks. But by the end of 6 weeks, there was no difference between the two groups. And then as part of the protocol, you had to wean people either off of placebo or off of alprazolam. And what they found is that those who had been randomized to placebo, they kept getting better over the next 8 weeks, while those who had been randomized to alprazolam, Xanax, they got much, much worse as they were withdrawn from the medications. A high percentage were unable to get off. They experienced all sorts of difficult withdrawal symptoms. And by the end of the 8 weeks, that group, on average, was having more panic attacks than when they entered into the study. And I forget exactly how much were the difference between the placebo group, but it was dramatic. So what you saw in that study was that this new drug could maybe curb anxiety, curb panic symptoms over the short term, a couple weeks. By the end of 6 weeks, there would be no difference compared to placebo. And then if they tried to come off, you were going to see all sorts of problems. You were going to see new symptoms emerge. Anxiety symptoms that were more severe than when they first came onto the drug would emerge. So that study clearly said this drug is addictive. And if you use it for long term, people, it's going to do harm on the whole because people are going to have trouble getting off the drug. And yet the marketing message, rather than that scientific finding, was what, you know, carried the day. And you just saw this message that Xanax was non-addictive, was easy to get off, there was no worry, and they were starting to be handed out like candy. And even in, you know, in common culture, you start to hearing people saying, take a Xanax, it's so easy. But still, it's 2020. So that study was done in the early 1980s, and now we have thousands and thousands and thousands of patient stories telling about people getting addicted to these drugs and people having trouble coming off of these medications. So, Garrett, you asked me, how did we get here? We got here because a marketing message outdid the science, and for reasons that sometimes I can't understand, physicians, and particularly general practitioners, they never changed their prescribing practices. And basically, once they had begun thinking you can just hand these out like candy, they're not problematic, they began doing it for all sorts of complaints, minor complaints. And I often see it as it almost became a ritual where someone would come into a doctor's office with some minor complaint. And let's be honest, in modern healthcare in the United States, doctors are under pressure to get rid of patients in 15 minutes. And prescribing a benzodiazepine was a way to, quote, respond to that problem and send people on their way. And the prescribing physician was just not thinking about how that first moment in which he or she was prescribing with not much thought could lead to such long-term difficulties for that person.
Interesting. And Bob, so you used a term there, betrayal of the American public. And to me, you know, I feel like those kind of decisions are made at like the 30,000 foot level that, you know, when you're talking to your doctor that you're going into, you're like, your doctor is really trying to help you. How is it that the wool gets pulled over the eyes of these doctors that do this for a living? Like, they're not at, I have to believe, because I mean, otherwise the medical profession can't exist anymore, that they really are trying to help you. Why is it that they're so willing to continue their prescribing practices?
So before Bob answers that, I actually had a question that is similar to that. Bob, when you came to the second hearing, and so you got to hear the doctors that came up against us. Now, they never stay to hear our stories, which is very sad. And when they've been asked to stay, and they're so, like, they're just, they won't listen. So how, and this is all for that, I mean, what is holding them back from learning? Because they really do need to relearn all this. There's enough stories now.
Yeah, sure. I think there was enough stories 20 years ago.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
The thing is, Garrett, I agree that doctors want to do well by their patients. On the other hand, they, first of all, once they start a practice, once they start saying handing out benzodiazepines with great frequency, they don't want to see the harm done. No physician really wants to see that a treatment, which he or she believes in, may cause harm. So what the story began to be, when people are having trouble coming off or having trouble on these drugs, it's not because of the drugs, but it's because of some other condition, some other mental disorder, right, some other psychiatric disorder. And that's a sort of cognitive dissonance that exists within physicians, in which they are loath to blame their treatments for any harms, any sort of worsening of a patient, and they look elsewhere for an explanation. And once they get into that mindset, by the way, that's a mindset that was encouraged by psychiatry, because that became sort of the story that was told by you know, thought leaders. And Geraldine, you saw that at the hearing where they said, if you remember this, we had a couple of benzodiazepine experts and they said, oh, I've never seen anybody with withdrawal problems.
Right.
I've never had any trouble getting anyone off. And those are the people giving continuing education classes, setting the tone in articles, in, you know, meetings with doctors, textbooks and all. So that became the official wisdom. Now, it was nonsense. And here's the final thing on this. So benzos get you into this corner of the world where people are psychiatric patients. And there's a longstanding tradition of saying that psychiatric patients aren't reliable witnesses to their own lives. And so you dismiss their problems. Either they're hypochondriacs or something else is going on. Right. And that was this sort of the back and forth or sort of the practicing milieu that developed. And I listen, even I was stunned. And I say even I can be pretty cynical, but even I was stunned at that hearing by this blanket denial that, oh, I've never had trouble getting people off. Well, I can get people off, no problem. And if you remember, there was somebody that they brought up that said, I've been on these drugs for 20 years and they're fantastic. It's never harmed my life.
Yeah.
So, and you're right, though. Did they stay to hear people one after another telling about how their lives had been, at the very least, sent down a bad path for a time, and it's sometimes basically ruined by being prescribed a benzo? Did they stay and listen for that? They
no.
didn't.
Right.
And so So Garrett, I agree that doctors want to do well by their patients, but at the same time, sometimes they're trained to sort of not listen to their patients.
Yeah. Bob, don't you think it's interesting, too, that, you know, they kind of dismiss a lot of the testimony that we provided that day by saying, you know, this is just anecdotal evidence and statistics kind of weed this out. But the first thing that they offer is another anecdote from a patient that it happened to work with.
Right.
Well, let's remember one thing that patient that he said he can just take a break from taking it. And my question was, why do you put him back on?
Yeah, exactly.
I will point out to everybody, too, that, you know, the fact that those doctors were in the room, you know, they're not lobbyists, but they were there with lobbyists representing, you know, certain interests. So they picked the right people with the right credentials to come in and say what they need to say. And well, it's impressive to a committee like that.
Yeah. One thing. American psychiatry, in many ways, two different things, but American psychiatry, starting after 1980 and DSM-3, they put all their eggs in one basket, and that was psychiatric drugs. They said, we're going to become psychopharmacologists, and we'll leave a lot of the counseling to psychologists and counselors, social workers, etc. So what's their product at that time? Their product is psychiatric drugs. And so they don't need to be lobbyists for another organization. They are members of a guild that needs to protect the image of these drugs. And one of the drugs they prescribe so frequently is, you know, our benzodiazepines. Now, we know that general practitioners also prescribe these drugs, but they're really looking to psychiatrists, academic psychiatrists, for the sort of prescribing habits that they should adopt. So when you saw those, oh, and by the way, academic psychiatrists in the United States, so many of them have financial ties to the makers of these drugs. They get research grants, they get grants for speaking, for giving continuing education, for serving as consultants on drug development projects. So they have two influences that can make them want to be protective of these drugs. One is the guild influence, because this is a product that, you know, with psychiatry in essence, this is what they have for the public. And two, they have ties to, so often is basically, you know, consulting ties, financial ties to pharmaceutical companies. So I just want to say one thing, though, going back to your question, Garrett. You said, oh, yeah, they said, that's just anecdotal. We believe in science. And then they bring out this one anecdote. But what I was there was to say, your science doesn't support your story. And we can go back to that 1980s trial, which was the first. It was a big trial conducted in the 1980s to look at this. And you saw right there, right then, in their own scientific literature, a story of how these drugs were going to do harm. They were going to be hard to come off of, all sorts of withdrawal symptoms. And when people did come off, so often they would have more anxiety than they experienced even when they went on. So science, there's a long record of science saying that the efficacy of benzodiazepines in sort of curbing anxiety doesn't last very long. Two, if you stay on for any sort of extended period, you may have trouble coming off, or very likely will, and have all sorts of withdrawal symptoms. And three, if you stay on, you may worsen as well. You may be, there's the evidence they become more agoraphobic, more anxious, etc. And last thing here, this information is actually on the drug inserts for, right, for benzodiazepines. This isn't something like where it's not known. Even the FDA is saying this is the case with these drugs.
Okay. All right. So speaking of the FDA, now that they've come out with the black box warning on all benzodiazepines, as much as I'm happy that this finally happened, I'm nervous because I feel like some doctors are going to start cutting people off, which has happened for years anyway. I'm afraid they'll be tapered too fast. They don't have enough information. What do you think is going to happen now with this situation, Bob? Because there's been so much information for so many years. Now this is finally out. You think it'll be ignored for a while? Or what does happen scientifically? Does information go out to all the doctors? What happens? Do you know?
You know, it diffuses into the general population rather slowly, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors, just because there's a black box warning, it doesn't mean they will really shift their prescribing habits dramatically right away. Mm-hmm. Some will, but others will not. Others will just sort of dismiss the black box warning, and they'll say, like those experts that you're hearing, oh, I know how to use these drugs. I know how to get people off. So it's those other people who don't know how to use these drugs in a smart way. So that'll be one response. But the other response, Geraldine, is I think what you just said. Other doctors may just say, oh, I'm not going to prescribe these drugs then, right? And,
right.
And they won't have the knowledge or the experience to do this safely and to be on the alert for all the problems that can arise when people come off. In other words, they won't do it slowly enough. They won't monitor their patients enough. And when patients start going through difficulties, including protracted withdrawal symptoms, I think many doctors, physicians who are now treating these patients in this way will once again say, oh, that's something other than withdrawal. That's some other problem.
They'll wind up on another drug.
Exactly.
You know? It's a very sad situation. Garrett, do you want any follow-up on that? Because I just want to mention, with this happening, you know, had the coronavirus not happened, we had actually made it out of committee this year with the legislation that we filed here in Massachusetts. So because of the virus, it's not going to go through. We'll file another bill. But had things happen, and hopefully things in the future, and let me just say, we shouldn't even have to have gotten to this point of legislation. There's been so much information, but I believe in symptom-guided tapering, as do most of us, but doctors don't. It's a kind of a one-size-fits-all. So I'm hoping, like, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, even if we can get things going here, I mean, like you said, it takes a long time. We've even had doctors, Harm, that say it's going to take a good 10 years. Now, that's before the FDA warning came out. They said it takes 10 years to really make a change with a drug. Can you imagine 10 more years of people being harmed who are dependent on these drugs? It's very, very sad.
Well, this shows what a hole we've dug here for people. I mean, the iatrogenic harm, iatrogenic meaning drug harm, is just extraordinary. And the problem is there isn't, for people who've been on these drugs a long time, there's no easy way out. I mean, you know this, Geraldine, because even when you come off the drugs and you've been off them for a time, the drugs have changed your brain, right? And they've changed your nervous system. Mm-hmm. So there's these protracted withdrawal symptoms that can just go on and on. And this goes back to your initial point about symptom-guided tapering. It seems it's so individualistic. So really, you're going to need doctors that listen closely to their patients, monitor them, and give feedback, give advice in response to whatever is happening to that individual. So in other words, they can't do this in a cookie cutter fashion, saying, oh, I'm supposed to taper my people, let's say, over a month, over 2 months, or over 3 months, and adhere to some protocol. That doesn't end up with good tapering. I mean, and with good results, right? But doctors aren't prepared today to spend the time with their patients and to listen to their patients to really guide symptom, you know, symptom-guided tapering that may be different from patient to patient. So what we really need here, and starting to see this in the UK, is like this incredible physician education program to say, boy, you're going to have to listen to your patients. Some of them are going to go through protracted withdrawal symptoms. Now what I'm going to say, Geraldine, you know 100 times better than me, but sometimes in essence, you have to you actually have to stop the tapering because the withdrawal symptoms become so severe for a while.
Right.
So doctors are going to have to be trained in how to do this in this individualistic way. And unfortunately, that's not how medicine is practiced today. So this benzodiazepine story is really a story of medical harm of extraordinary magnitude. I mean, and I guess what you hear in stories, and again, Geraldine, you know this 100 times better than me, but what you hear in personal stories over and over again is people had a minor problem. You know, whether it be something with a divorce or some physical ailment, and next thing you know, they get a prescribed benzodiazepine. And 3 years later, their problems have mounted, 4 years later. And then when they try to come off, boy, do you see some horrible times with people trying to come off.
Oh, the suffering is unbelievable. But I got to tell you one thing, Bob. The two doctors that you saw speak at the hearing. So we had a person here in Massachusetts that needed a doctor desperately because her doctor was going to cut her off. She couldn't bear going through that. So I thought, oh, where am I going to get a doctor? And I thought, well, I'm going to give her one of the doctors that came to the hearing that thinks these drugs are fine. So he saw her. He was wonderful to her. And honestly, I believe because of our hearings, he's learned. He's letting her, one thing he learned was there was something in the brand that she had that was making her very sick, changed the brand for her. He's doing a very slow taper. And I said to her, don't ever tell him I sent you. And, he said to her, we're learning. We got this wrong. We're learning. So it'll be interesting if we have another hearing, if he comes in and kind of sticks up for us a little bit.
He said, we got this wrong.
We got this wrong. We're learning. Can you imagine? Now, I don't think he'll ever come up and testify and say that, but whenever anybody in the Boston area needs a doctor, I send them to him now because I can remember at the first hearing when five of them came in to speak against us, they looked at us like we had the plague, but he actually said to me, you know, when I said something to him, like they wouldn't speak to us. And I said, I was told to come off in 2 weeks. He said, oh no, that would be too fast. Like I could tell he had a little bit of a heart. And so I thought, well, let's try him. And he's been wonderful to everybody I sent. He actually is letting them go based on how they feel. So did he learn? Because he never heard anybody's testimony except for mine, because they listen to mine. Then they get up and speak, and then they leave. But he's certainly hearing from the people I'm sending into him. So I thought you'd be pleased to know one doctor is making a little bit of a change.
Well, I am pleased to hear that.
He's got a heart.
Also, though, put you in this position where you see that maybe doctors know more privately than they're willing to admit publicly. So they feel the need to sort of protect the institution publicly, even while they know something's going wrong on a patient level.
Well, you know, that's interesting because I wanted to bring up when we had lunch with you a couple of years ago when we were being filmed for the documentary As Prescribed, a couple of discussions came up that I thought, oh, this would be really good to have on the podcast. And one was when you talked about Massachusetts Medical Society, where their funding comes from. And you know, all that goes along with that. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies basically own them, right? So, but what was the original purpose for medical societies in each state? That's one thing I'd love to know.
What happened with the Massachusetts Medical Society, and this goes back 20 some years, I think, is that the way they sort of owned them was, okay, so the Massachusetts Medical Society publishes various journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine. And those journals are really funded by ads that are placed, you know, by pharmaceutical ads that are placed in the journal and also reprints and that sort of thing. So even if the money isn't, you know, a straight grant or anything like that, as publishers of journals, they're dependent on pharmaceutical money for those journals. So this is another sort of corrosive factor in our in modern medicine, is that the very medical journals we look to and doctors look to for like all the best advice, the best results, well, they're dependent on pharmaceutical advertising to continue. So you can see the conflict of interest there, and how that can be such a corrupting influence. And I remember this, I think, goes back to around 1998, when Marcia Angel was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and she had a special issue that sort of focused on this corruption of clinical research and clinical trials and what was being published in medical journals because of this pharmaceutical influence. Now, again, New England Journal of Medicine is published by Massachusetts Medical Society, or at least it was at that time. And what happened? She got kicked out, and they brought in someone that, quote, was going to be more friendly to industry, is basically what the message was.
Oh, it's so corrupt. That's awful. That's awful. Well, you know, interesting, one of the doctors, not who spoke, that he was very busy and now he's retired, and I stay in touch with him because he very much sees what is happening with benzodiazepines. And he suggested that I contact the Massachusetts Medical Society, you know, before we have a hearing again. And I thought, okay, now that the FDA black box warning is out, would they be nice to me if I called? I often wonder, would they? I mean, I've never had any contact with them. I haven't done it. I feel like, you know, they're this power force that would like hurt me, you know, because, and I'm not against benzodiazepines. I'm for the responsible use. We know they have use in very short term. And also for people who have severe panic, you got to feel bad when they're panicking, but then find out why. There's a reason why. There's always a reason why. Is it another med? So I'm hoping if I do approach the Mass Medical Society that they will at least listen this
time.
You know,
I would hope and sort of expect they would, because, you know, in the UK, for example, there's increasing admission acknowledgement within the British, Royal Psychiatry, their association of problems with benzodiazepines. It's getting government recognition as well. So when you see that happening just across the pond, so to speak, and you know, when the leaders in the Massachusetts medicine see that, they know they have a duty to be responsive, that this is a new issue, it's coming up at a national level. So actually, Geraldine, I would expect they would be very gracious in their response to you.
I hope so. So one of the other things, Bob, at that luncheon, which I thought was fantastic, was you had just come back from Norway, if I remember right, and you were talking about how they were handling mental illness. And I hate to even say mental illness, because probably most are sick from, you know, psychiatric drugs. But so what are other countries, not just Norway, you were saying how they're handling things more naturally, and what are other countries doing to help withdraw from medications, or just in general, what are they doing? Because that was quite an interesting conversation.
That's a big subject, actually. So what happened in Norway, just for, as an example, is in Norway is a government that is set up to really listen to the population. You know, I forget, I think it's about 5 million people who live there. And so on every hospital board or hospital governing, there has to be patient representation. And patients can also basically make appeals to the Ministry of Health. And there, so what happened in Norway, patient groups for a long time said, and this really, we're talking about people with psychotic disorders or very severe depression, bipolar, said, some of us want to be able to get care in a hospital setting, but do so without being forced to take medication. In other words, we want environmental care. Maybe we want a place to rest and sort of recover in that way. So the Norway government passed a law requiring all of its, I guess it was actually a declaration by the Ministry of Health, requiring all of its health districts, there's 4 health districts there, to start setting aside beds for patients, psychiatric patients, who wanted care but didn't want to take psychiatric drugs. So that I forget how long that's been going now, 4 or 5 years, 4 years maybe. And now there's a hospital outside of Oslo, which bills itself as the first medication-free hospital in the world. It's talking about psychiatric medications. Wow. Now, in fact, people are going there to taper off of medications. But it's a lovely place by a lake. And they're getting people off. Their very first patient came to them on 31 medications. She had been hospitalized over 200 times. She was on multiple benzodiazepines, by the way. And when within 2 years, I think it was 3 years, she was down to one drug. She hadn't been hospitalized again. She was now working and living outside the hospital setting. So it showed the possibilities when you set up a recovery center where people can take time to slowly come off basically a cocktail of medications. You're seeing that, by the way, in Israel is setting up some residences for people, well, really, again, seriously mentally people, psychotic people who want to recover without necessarily taking antipsychotics. So that's happening. And in England, for example, there is now a group in Parliament that has been set up to study dependence that arises from psychiatric drugs and really focusing on SSRIs and benzodiazepines. That's the two classes of drugs. And so the fact that the Parliament has a work group to get dedicated to this is really making it a topic of concern in the UK. And what are you finding? You're getting admissions by the medical establishment, by the psychiatric establishment. Yes, SSRIs can cause dependence, and they can be very difficult to withdraw from. Same with benzodiazepine. And there's an admission that the medical profession has never really studied this. And so there's just so much to learn about, like, why is it so hard to come off these drugs? Why do you get protracted withdrawal symptoms? How do we need to develop sort of an understanding where it's going to be so individualistic in terms of how we try to help people come off these drugs? Now, also, Geraldine and Garrett, 4 years ago, I helped co-found an international group called the International Institute for Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. And we have people from many different countries, researchers, people with lived experience. We wanted both. We have prescribers, researchers, people with lived experience. So we wanted this mix of people with the idea this International Institute would foster collaborative research, promote information about the problems with psychiatric drug withdrawal, make political efforts. And that, I think, is starting to make a difference. And, you know, I run this organization called MAD in America, a website. And beginning in January, we're going to start sponsoring town halls to where people can come on and discuss these issues and learn about these issues. And I think the time has really come, because so many people are on these drugs, for making this a sort of a national discussion. And hopefully it will leak out into the general media.
Good. Well, I wanted to mention Mad in America. So we have a lot of medical professionals now that are listening and slowly learning. And when they go to madinamerica.com, it's .com, right?
No,
or is that .org?
.com. Even though it's a nonprofit, .com. We initially started as a regular organization. But go on.
Okay. So when they go to your website, what can they learn there? What can they go in and read, personal stories and articles? What can they learn there?
First of all, they can search for personal stories. We have at least one personal story a week. So we've been doing this for 8 years. So there's hundreds of personal stories, and they can search for those that tell of benzodiazepine withdrawal, benzodiazepine suffering, that sort of thing. So first of all, they can review personal stories. Then they can also search our scientific literature. So what we do is we review scientific journals and basically provide summaries of findings which never get out into the mainstream media because they counter the conventional wisdom. So you can go there and basically see what sort of information has come up in research journals about benzodiazepines in the last 4 or 5 years. And that'll be surveys of people trying to withdraw from psychiatric drugs, including benzodiazepines, sense of, you know, how addictive they are, what percentage of people end up sort of dependent on these drugs, that sort of thing. So they get a a chance to quickly, through a search function, look at scientific articles that may have appeared on this topic. And then we also are building a resource section. We haven't actually finished the part for benzodiazepines, but we have for antipsychotics and antidepressants. And that just puts together a comprehensive overview of the science related to the safety and efficacy of these drugs, what type of withdrawal symptoms you see, how the drugs act on the brain. And we're in the process of doing that for benzodiazepines as well. So you can do that. If you're a parent, there's a parent section for if you have a 18-year-old or a 19-year-old that really focuses on what happens to kids on these drugs. And that benzodiazepine section is finished, if I remember correctly. And then finally, so you can go on there and you get all these information, resources that really just aren't available in the general media or on other websites. So I think we're pretty unique in that. And it's a combination of science reviews, resource material, and personal stories that are available there. And then we've also do continuing education. We have recordings of continuing education recordings, and several of the presentations have been about psychiatric drug withdrawal. So you can go sign up and take those courses as well.
That's excellent. It really has a wealth of information on there, and that's why I want to send people there to, because we have a lot of people that they're family members. What's one of the biggest problems? Nobody believes them. They're doctors, they're family. So it's great that they can go there and there's something for everybody.
I think partly what they'll also find there is exactly what you're just talking about. So people come off, right? They've been on a benzo or sometimes, an antidepressant, and they suffer, and they suffer like 5 months later, 6 months later, and nobody believes them, right? Oh, you can't be. Right. Your drug was out of your body, months ago. Well, what you'll find in the personal stories there, and in fact in the research, is people can find a validation of their experience on Mad in America.
Right. And validation is everything. In fact, when Heather Ashton wrote the manual for me, I needed something that would validate what we were going through. And that was the first thing we had to start showing that it was for real, And I mean, there were scientific articles for years, but this was something that I wanted her to write it just easy for laypersons to read, but to hand to your doctor. And, it's just gone on too long, but the change is coming. It's happening. And your website's going to bring a lot of knowledge.
Thank you. But,
people.
I think that validation is such a healing moment for people through this because they can be so alone. Everybody's doubting them. There's, that makes them ever more isolated. And then they can read these personal stories about other people who saw their lives blow up on benzodiazepines and other people. And I'm talking blow up in the sense they became more dysfunctional, less able to go to work, that sort of thing. And then how, when they came off, they went through these extended periods of suffering, as you say. And when you see that, you say, okay, I'm not crazy. This is a real thing that I have experienced. And that gives you strength and comfort. And that's one of the things I think I'm really proud about Mad in America is it does provide that validation for people going through this.
Right. It's everything, Bob. It really is. Garrett, do you have any more questions for Bob?
Yeah. So, Bob, back in the day when we used to be able to congregate at bars and restaurants.
What was that?
A long, long time ago. When we were trying to get co-sponsors for the benzo bill, I was at a bar that, legislators and attorneys kind of frequent up on Beacon Hill. And I sat and had a drink with a couple of legislators that I wanted on the bill. And the way that I sold them their co-sponsorship was I said that the issue of benzodiazepines is going to be unavoidable in 10 years. And somebody is going to point out to you that 10 years ago, you could have done something about it and you didn't because you weren't paying attention. Do you see us eventually getting to a tipping point where it becomes like the opioid epidemic and every legislature in the country or Congress has to deal with the issue?
Well, that's a great question. Here's what I see that may be happening. So in the UK, of course, you have a National Health Service, right? And because of that, they really do set national guidelines for everybody. And their guidelines are in the process of being changed related to benzodiazepines and antidepressants. And I think when the UK establishment really recognizes this as a problem, recognize and begins to reorganize its response to that problem, I think that could really legitimize the political a political response here, or encourage a political response here. I wish it could happen de novo here, on its own here, that we would have legislators that would respond and the medical community that would respond. But it's 2020. And you had a Kennedy hearing in 19, I don't know what it was, Ted Kennedy.
It was 41 years ago.
You know, it was known and it just didn't change. I mean, it changed a little bit, but then, you know, once Xanax came, that started becoming a real popular drug. So, Garrett, I wish I were more optimistic. I guess 41 years makes you a little pessimistic.
And I've been doing this for a little over 20. How sad is that?
And you know what else I find amazing? And tell me if I'm wrong on this. Your efforts were to get an informed consent, right? Wasn't that part of what you wanted?
Informed consent. If we want for a short-term reason, small prescription like 10 pills. We also wanted to protect long-term uses, that no one is to be taken off without a discussion, that it could say, nope, I'm going to stay on them. Because I had childhood friends that had been, I have one childhood friend's been on 40 years now, went in as a young 20-year-old and just given 3 milligrams of Klonopin just like that. It's ridiculous. We did a podcast with her and it's just ruined her life. And and what was there was a fourth thing. I think there were four things we wanted.
The commission to study.
Oh, commission to study, right. Yeah. Because we want symptom guided tapers. So asking for much. Just common sense.
The fact that you're not calling for them to be banned, really just saying, can we learn as a society to use these drugs, which, as you said, Geraldine, that there are moments when they can be helpful on a certain situation. Like, let's say you're just afraid of flying, for example. If you need to take a benzo for the flight, okay. It just seems like, why would there be resistance to this? I just don't. Sometimes it's mind-boggling to me that there just wouldn't be a legislature that would agree to this.
Right. I think, is it profits over people? You know, because you start giving benzodiazepines and because people become dependent, you got a patient for life until they learn, you know. You hate to say it, but that's, I mean, what other reason? Especially when people are going to their doctors saying, this is here, look at this, I have information. They're like, absolutely not. Nope, stop reading that stuff.
I think there's a power thing going on, though, too. So the legislature is much more loath to, it's somewhat hesitant to contradict medical authorities, right?
Well, Garrett got, didn't you get some nasty emails and phone calls when the first one went out?
I mean, I've gotten them since day one, like, because once you file a bill, it becomes public knowledge. I think from day one that I filed that first bill, I started getting emails that were, you know, pretty nasty towards me or towards my boss, who, you know, is the primary sponsor of the bill.
Yeah,
like, who do they think they are? I mean, nobody's trying to take their benzo away from them. If anything, if you're on one, we're trying to protect you so that no doctor will ever cut you off.
But that shows where the legislature sees the power so much, because, in other words, the medical establishment, you know, remember, medicine's a big business in Massachusetts. It's a big business. So they're sort of loath to curb that authority. And unfortunately, who are you? Your patients, right? I mean, you're more easily ignored is the problem, is what I'm saying, in the political landscape.
Right.
And I think it's that power differential that has made this so hard to, you know, enact into legislation.
Right. Well, we're not going to solve it all, but we're certainly trying to make a dent. And, you know, hey, we'll just keep going. We'll just keep going, Bob. And I got to thank you so much for doing this, because I could do this for hours with you. You have so much information. It's great.
Yeah. Thank you, Bob. And I think definitely we're going to need to do a part two to this podcast at some point down the line.
This will be great for people to have their family members listen to it.
Thank you for the kind
too.
Words. But one thing here, Geraldine and Garrett, you guys have been pounding away at this for so long. And Geraldine, I don't know anybody in the United States has done more than you to bring awareness to this issue.
Well,
and getting
you.
Heather Ashton to write that manual, which became such a guide for so many people. So I just want to say, man, I really admire you two for staying on this course, because it's not an easy battle.
Well, hopefully if we file again, Bob, you'll be able to make it to the next hearing. They're always entertaining from the medical side and
hopefully
the suffering.
Hopefully it's not over Zoom either.
Yeah, not over Zoom, but yeah. And we see the suffering every year, more and more people coming, and it is just heartbreaking. And that's what we're trying to stop. So again, we appreciate
your
time, Bob.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Bob.
Boy, Garrett, I have to say that was a fantastic podcast with Bob. He is just, he's amazing. He has all the facts, you know, the years, the dates, the names. He was just a pleasure to interview.
Yeah, I think when we first discussed doing the podcast, I mean, that was, Bob was one of the first names that we ever talked about being on the podcast. And, you know, I'm kind of glad that we waited to like this late in the game to get him on, because we're getting better and better at this. You know, we struggled through our first few podcasts, but...
And I still get nervous for every single one.
Which, you know, is surprising, given all the talking that you do on a daily basis on the phone. It's like, this is just on the phone through the computer.
I know. It's different. Feels different.
Bob is very knowledgeable. The first time I ever met him, we talked at that lunch. But, I mean, I think I said to him, like, you have to testify. And... he brought up an interesting point, and it's something that I've said privately to people. And, you know, now having my own committee that deals with experts coming in, it's very difficult to get over the hurdle of the Mass Medical Society that, you know, it's like, it's moving this giant rock, and there is like a power dynamic between the legislature and the medical community, because it's difficult for, you know, for the most part, a legislature or Congress is made up of lawyers. They don't know much about what's happening, you know, what the prevailing knowledge of the day is in the medical world. So how do we tell you that benzos are dangerous if you're telling us, you know, who we rely on to be the experts, they're not dangerous? So sometimes, you know, when these lobbyists bring in doctors to talk, the conversation's over before it even starts, because the people that are supposed to be the experts in the room aren't on your side.
So you mentioned lobbyists. So there were lobbyists every time we've gone in. Have they already pre-talked to everybody on that committee? Because I don't see them talking to anybody when we're there, because they're scary people, and you tell me, don't go near them. They'll eat you alive.
I said that to you?
Yeah. One time I went to go over to talk to one. You're like, do not speak to her.
Well, I think when I said do not speak to her, in the moment, don't speak to her, because, you know, it's game time when you're in an actual hearing. It's not the time to have a conversation with her. She's there to represent her interests. She's being paid to do what she does. It doesn't matter what you have to say to her. She's on that side. Same thing with like a lawyer. You could go over before you walk into court and have the best argument in the world. It doesn't matter. You know, they're doing their job.
Yeah, but have they pre-talked? Have they gone around the building and talked to people on that committee?
I can't say whether they have or haven't on that particular issue, but yeah, that's the job of a lobbyist.
Jeez.
So they don't speak necessarily at most hearings, but it's their job to make sure that those doctors are there and giving the right testimony. And that's what was happening that day.
Each time we've gone. Three times we've gone.
Right, yeah.
Three times there's been lobbyists.
Mm-hmm.
We just can't afford, you know, in our benzo community, we can't afford to get a lobbyist. You know, we go in with the truth.
And honestly, it wouldn't matter if you had a lobbyist. You know, I considered myself and Representative McMurtry to be the people that are on the inside for you, seeing what happens and having conversations with people. But, you know, get the best lobbyists in the whole world they're still not going to have Mass Medical Society on their side. And as soon as they walk in or they write their letter, which we never see, it just goes directly to the committee or goes to the chairs and, you know, it's dispersed. You know, the conversation's over before it starts.
Okay, but now here's the thing. Bob has written many books. He has all the facts in there. Why, when somebody, you know, we have patients going to doctors saying they're sick from these drugs, these are drugs they're prescribing that they can't take 5 minutes of their life to start looking how many articles are coming up. This is the sad part, that here, I've been doing this for over 20 years. Ted Kennedy, 41 years ago this year, he was doing his committee. It's been known for years. It really is. It is a hurdle to get over this. But now with the FDA warning, what's going to happen? I just hope mass panic doesn't happen. You know?
Yeah, and I think something that we didn't talk about with Bob, when we're talking about doctors, I think the problem sometimes is the situation that they find themselves in their careers. You know, they really are pushed to spend about 8 to 13 minutes with you, somewhere in that ballpark. You know, the easiest thing to do in those 8 to 13 minutes is, well, the prevailing knowledge of the time is this person has this anxiety issue, whatever it is, and you give them a benzo. They're out the door and they're in their 8 to 13 minutes. You don't have an hour, a couple of hours, time after time after time to give this person. And on top of it, they're probably in debt themselves and they're stuck in that kind of cycle of getting people in and out because they need to pay the bills.
But, you know, when you mentioned people go in with anxiety, when we went to the first committee, I had a page, 3 pages long, when we had asked online, why were you put on a benzodiazepine? Anxiety was like the least. They were put on for 3 pages of reasons. They walked in and walked out with a benzodiazepine.
Yeah.
That's got to stop.
But unfortunately,
it's going to take time.
You know, the reason why I was asking Bob to kind of look into his crystal ball, as I was hoping he was going to give me like this, you know, the future looks bright and, you know, things will eventually change. I don't know if it necessarily will, because if you're relying on political bodies to make a change, I don't know. That's, you're really asking for a grand slam there with that. It has to come from the medical world. And to be honest, we've both had private conversations with doctors that understand what's going on.
Right.
But they feel like, oh, there's nothing, you know, I can really do. And, you know, for me to be the first one to kind of out what's going on puts my whole world, you know, in jeopardy. You know, can I pay for my mortgage if I'm not practicing the way I normally am? You know, and it's a lot to ask somebody to do.
Right. But, you know, this is the sad part, is when you prescribe one and people become dependent on them, they keep going back. Now they have to go monthly for their prescription. If you help somebody taper, just to have that doctor that understands, you're going to go back. You just want that understanding, you know, because you're still going to need that script as you're tapering. So there, you know, you hate to say there's money involved here, but if money is what they're interested in, help somebody come off. You know, with that you can still have a patient, but we need doctors to help them come off, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping when Holly Hodman's film As Prescribed comes out that more, you know, when that gets out there, and I think she's been doing a great job on it, that there's another avenue. You know, there's all these YouTubes out there, and Shane Kenny had done his, and, you know, there's Medicating Normal that's out there. So there's going to be more and more out there, I think, as the years go by, and more testimonies that people have, and, you know.
Yeah.
But thank you, Garrett. You did a great job with this.
Thank you.